listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and the total health environment. Everything we need for our health and well-being, healthy food, water, air, earth, healthy communities, a healthy society, a healthy earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different advocates, experts, organizers, authors, scientists, and others, about policy experts, about all of the things that are shaping the health that we enjoy and the well-being that we enjoy and pass on to our children, to other species, to future generations. That's what we talk about every Wednesday at 10 a.m. here on Connect the Dots. I'm a long-standing journalist of health, food, and the environment. You can find my blogs on Alternet, EcoWatch, and TruthDig, as well as the Huffington Post. So thank you for being with us today for this edition of the show. I'm very excited to have guests with us with some breaking news stories and breaking science all in one show. So stay tuned. Today, our guests are David Murphy and Lisa Stocky. They are the co-founders and directors of Food Democracy Now. Dave is the executive director, Lisa the co-director, and for over 5 years, this terrific organization has stood up for food, for farming, for farmers, for the rights to know what is in our food. We have some breaking news events, things that they have been very active on. They've been on our show before, and I'm delighted to have them back again. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, David and Lisa. Hello, guys. Hello. Well, we seem to be having a technical problem of some kind here because I'm not hearing them.
Can you hear us?
Okay, there. I just heard you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Allison. How are you doing? Pleasure to be on.
It's great that you're here with us. Is Lisa here today, or are you going to be speaking with us today but on your own today?
Lisa's on.
Can you hear me, Allison?
Okay, Lisa's on too. Okay, great. Yeah, we had a little technical problem there at the beginning. Great to have you guys on. And it's been a very active month on multiple fronts. So we're going to have a number of windows opening today. First off, I want to bring up, the kind of big news of the last 10 days or so. The title of this show is Will America Go Dark Over Food? And that's a reference to the so-called DARK Act, denial of Americans' right to know what's in their food, which has just passed an unfortunate legislative hurdle in the U.S. Congress. Dave, can you fill us in about what this act is and what it means?
Sure. Well, it's H.R. 1599. It was introduced by Congressman Mike Pompeo of Kansas. He's a Republican. And he's in the district for the Koch brothers in Kansas. That's his legislative district. They introduced it last year, basically at the behest of Monsanto, the Grocery Manufacturers Association. And last week, tragically, it passed by a large margin of 250 votes to 150. And what it does is basically takes away states' rights. The last 4 years, we've had a very growing movement to label genetically engineered foods here in the U.S. with 4 ballot initiatives and that have had fights over GMO labeling, and 26 states that have introduced bills. And this is the industry's way to kind of short-circuit that and preempt states' rights. It would actually make it illegal for states to pass GMO labeling laws. It would get rid of bans, current existing county bans. In, I think there's 6 counties in California, in Hawaii, and then last year we wanted Jackson and Josephine County. And it would take away those counties' rights to regulate genetically engineered foods in their counties. So it's a pretty, it's a pretty devastating, and we would consider it an unconstitutional bill, but everything is up to, if it passed the Senate, was signed into law, we'd have to go, it would be a court fight to prove that.
Mm-hmm. It's this is it's really terrible, but also, you know, a sad opportunity to kind of see where things are in our democracy, I have to say. You know, last fall, almost a year ago now, at the time that there was a kind of very close vote, which we've covered on the show before, and which you both were very active in, on gaining the right to label and to know in the state of Oregon, which won by a very, very, you know, it was defeated by a very, very narrow, tiny margin. And I was on one of the Facebook pages of a very well-known food activist group, and basically there was hardly anything on the page about this very close loss and the fact that, you know, people really need to register, get involved, register to vote, get involved and participate, be better informed so they're not as easily misled by the barrage of advertising money that usually flows in to influence people prior to big votes like this. And on, you know, there was, as is the case on many pages, you can only comment on an existing thing rather than, you know, just freely post in a place where people will see. So they had a post up about a win. I think it was in Humboldt County, California. And they were like, yay, Humboldt County, you know, we won, hooray, hooray. And I commented in my usual sort of acerbic manner. I was like, yay, you know, we won Humboldt County, but we, you know, it was a close loss in California, it was a close loss in Washington State, and now it's a close loss in Oregon. And somebody wrote back to me, and they were like, don't be a downer. What, you know, I mean, can't you celebrate? We're so happy. And I'm like, well, you know, quite frankly, it's lovely that your county passed this, but a countywide victory is not equivalent to a statewide victory. Why? Because, you know, all of the other counties would have been along for the ride and, you know, and part of it rather than one county. So if you have to go state by state, it isn't as favorable a situation for knowing the right to know what's in your food as it would be if you had a federal law to that effect. On the other hand, it's better than, you know, to be able to go state by state is a way to put the pieces of the puzzle together, which you've been doing. You've been close. Awareness has been building. If you have to go county by county within each state, it's even harder work to really get to that tipping point where, you know, the food is labeled for everyone. And, you know, you've really been doing the valiant effort, but there's this, you know, this wipes out the county effort, it wipes out the state effort, you know, and yet there's this kind of tremendous naivete that somehow, that I see among people, you know, somehow we can make it right, or, you know, I mean, I think people are really unprepared for this kind of pulling the rug out from under all of these efforts and really from the will of the people. Your comments.
Well, real quickly, you know, I definitely agree with that. I think in a lot of ways our movement lives in the land of magical thinking. You have, it's a very progressive movement and, you know, left-leaning, and or the organic industry was founded by hippies who basically rejected society and to start, you know, non-chemical agriculture, which is great in terms of the food we want to produce, but they don't always have the most sophisticated understanding of politics and the ramifications of politics. And I would just say, you know, everyone, we should celebrate county bans, but we shouldn't celebrate victories like that. But, you know, losing Oregon was a tragic loss. So we lost by 837 votes. It was that close. And basically Oregon Secretary of State, who then became, is now governor, she denied us a final count on 4,600 votes, which would have, could have tossed it into our favor. So, but, you know, listen, the thing is, what's happening in Congress right now, they are intentionally trying to steal our rights and trying to short-circuit this growing movement. They know poll after poll shows 85 to 94% of Americans want labeling. Everyone wants to know what's in their food. Despite what, you know, Montana and the Grocery Manufacturers Association say, and they're trying to short-circuit that. You know, if the only good news is it's a much higher hurdle for the Senate to pass a bill than the House.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The House, for some reason, was a foregone conclusion that they would pass.
Mm-hmm.
I think the House is a little bit less sophisticated in its understanding of the 10th Amendment, which is the violation of states' rights. And they don't
mm-hmm.
really care. They just like they tried to repeal Obamacare 30 times. They only do that to appease the, you know, the Tea Party voters
mm-hmm.
and then their donors.
Mm-hmm. But I'm puzzled. I mean, isn't states' rights a big Tea Party issue?
It is. Ironically, yes. Republicans are supposed to be champions of states' rights, but not when it comes to something that their corporate donor class, you know, this is kind of a handout to Monsanto. And this is where you see what really, how Congress really operates, where the rubber really hits the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, they're willing to violate a so-called central tenet of conservatism or in the Tea Party, which is states' rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, it's kind of incredible that would actually go on. You know, but you say that in the Senate it's less likely to pass, but this is a cautionary tale then about who we elect to the House. Are you worried about its passing in the Senate, or what do you think, how does that look, and when might a vote be coming?
Well, the earliest a vote would happen would be September. They're away for
mm-hmm.
a recess, and we expect that it could happen in September. But I'll just
mm-hmm.
say it's a higher hurdle. They don't have to get a simple majority. They have to get 60 votes,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. So
mm-hmm.
two-thirds. And, you know, we do have some champions in the Senate that have stood up in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Like Senator Tester from Montana,
mm-hmm.
Boxer from California, Feinstein from California. We think
mm-hmm.
that we do have a core group of people in the Senate that would support us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really good news. Let's switch gears before we go to the science discussion that we're going to have and talk a little bit about the trade agreements. You've been on the program before. and I invite listeners to go back into our archives and listen to a terrific show that you did along with Adam Weissman probably back in late May, June, talking about the trade deals. The vote has now gone through to give the president authority to sign them via fast track, which means there's a shortened time period for consideration about what they contain. They're still being negotiated as we speak. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the so-called Pacific Agreement, TPP, is actually being negotiated in Hawaii as we speak. There's also a European agreement, TTIP, the Trans-Atlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, as well as TISA, T-I-S-A, another trade international services agreement. I hope I have that one right, actually. And we've been discussing all of those on the show all along. I think one of the concerns is, it seems, I mean, in just shorthand, the Pacific Agreement, the TPP, we're negotiating with countries that have lower food, health, and environmental standards than we do, and there's the danger that they're foods will pass over our borders and just come to us without any, or having any country of origin labeling or any other labeling to say how they were produced, what might be in them, where they come from. In Europe, in the Atlantic Agreement, the opposite is the case. They have higher standards than we do, and the goal seems to be in those agreements to bring down everyone's standards to the lowest level. What do you see in either or both of those agreements, that will relate to food labeling, whether people will know whether GMOs are in their food, whether toxic chemicals are in their food, whether antibiotics are in their food, you know, et cetera? I mean, where would those treaties, from what we know from leaks and surmise, put us in terms of our ability to kind of make see what ingredients are, what's happening with our food, so that we can make the right consumer choices for ourselves and our families?
Well, I definitely think that these agreements are, they're a disaster for the making for the American public and every country that they're being that are citing them. Mm-hmm. It's really a race to the bottom. I mean, I think the main provision that there, just so you know, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, the PATH, contained language that that says that labeling of genetically engineered foods is considered a unnecessary trade barrier. So they do find labeling, and with, as you know, the investor-state dispute settlement clause, which is the main provision that allows corporations to sue states, national governments and county governments, local governments. If they pass a law, if you pass a law to ban Roundup in your county, and Monsanto declared that that hindered their profits, they could sue you, and then they could sue you for profits, lost profits. And this has happened all over the world with the World Trade Organization. They said they're going to set up a secret tribunal court to mediate corporate lawsuits that corporations mm-hmm. bring against states and nations. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty appalling. It would have a real devastating effect. It would force us to accept, Mexico and China are probably the only two nations out there that have lower standards, food safety standards, than the U.S. And it would force us to accept their food. Mm-hmm. But this is really a way for corporations just to open markets and jam GMOs down Europe's throat and all of Asia. That's mm-hmm. what they'll be doing.
Mm-hmm. And, this is also, I mean, it's a kind of strange thing because let's say, if the Dark Act were to pass the Senate, it's kind of like the U.S. Congress, due to corporate influence, has already done the dirty work for these companies. In the event that it does not pass, these trade agreements could accomplish a similar purpose. Does that mean that, for example, Vermont, which has passed a GMO labeling bill, and labeling is due to begin, next year, isn't it? Isn't that right? Does
July,
that mean that these...
July of next year.
July of next year. So that means the labels have to be changed. That's already in process because it's not something that you can just snap your fingers and do probably in 2 minutes. Does that mean then, if these international laws are passed, what happens to a place like Vermont or other places that, are having plans to do this?
Well, they could actually roll back the GMO labeling laws in Europe. They could actually use this to roll back the law in Vermont. I mean, it would be a lawsuit based on lost profits from Monsanto and Grocery Manufacturers Association. Mm-hmm. And they could roll it back. But the mm-hmm. thing is, Vermont becomes law in July, and corporations, we're hearing that, food companies are panicking right now because they'll have to change their labels as early as October, meaning mm-hmm. that they'll have to put that into the machinery and they'll have to start designing the labels. I mean, here's mm-hmm. the funny thing. Lisa was telling me about last night about there's a study that just came out. I hadn't seen it, but it sounds interesting, and she can tell you more. Basically, how they there's a new study that shows that labels will not impact people's perceptions of the food that they're buying. So all this fear-mongering from Monsanto and the Grocery Manufacturers Association and spending $100 million in 3 years to kill a ballot initiative is kind of needless. Mm-hmm. Lisa, did you want to talk about that?
Let's hear about that.
Mm-hmm. It was a study that was just conducted, and I'm sorry, I can't remember where the study came out of right now. I have to look it up. I just saw it last night. But it was just presented at a, agricultural conference in San Francisco a couple of days ago. But basically, it responds to the idea that, what we've heard in working on all these ballot initiatives over the last several years, that they say, this is a warning label. We don't need to have this kind of label saying that, this ingredient in this product is genetically engineered or it contains genetically engineered ingredients because, people will think of it as a warning label. And, of course, our argument has always been this is just information on the package that we feel that the American people deserve. And so the study said that when they – actually, I think it came out of school of – University of Vermont, maybe. I think that's where it came out of. So they said that, we have found, polling residents of Vermont, citizens of Vermont, that they don't really see this as a warning label. And so, I thought that was interesting. And that's always been our argument, that this is just more information, and it's the information that consistently 90% of Americans have said that they wanted, that citizens in 64 other countries, you know, already have. They already have that right to know if their food is created with genetic engineering.
And, I mean, so basically that follows that if people know, then the people who don't want to eat them aren't eating them, but it isn't like the industry would be wiped out overnight because some people, some percentage of the population. So wanting to know, and then what you do with that knowledge is, you know, kind of your business. I mean, I think a lot of people have the idea, you know, consumers' rights, my choice as a consumer, is the way that I give feedback about, what I like and what I don't like, and somehow there's a, you know, wishful thinking that it's all powerful. But in fact, you know, it's just really what you're pointing out is a basic right. Some people may choose to do something with it, and some may not. So, in terms of for the people who don't want to eat these foods for health reasons or for environmental toxicity reasons because of all of the pesticides that, you know, are used in growing these kinds of foods, in fact, their desisting from eating them may not be as world-changing as perhaps people have hoped. That's kind of the other side of this message. But let's, you know, so that's kind of an interesting cautionary. So it's not like labeling is going to right away make these foods go away and deter the pesticide use or other things that people are concerned about, although individuals can sustain whatever, you know, or forestall whatever negative health impact they might perhaps be concerned about. So, you know, by not eating them. So, but let me just ask you another question, which is, you know, we've come also, ironically, in the same time frame, a step closer to actually understanding, you know, some possible new issues around the healthfulness of these foods because of recent science. And you all have been part of helping people become better informed about that. Can you tell our listeners about the new scientific study about GMO foods?
Yeah, well, Allison, I mean, I think you make a very good point. The question is, you know, people have a right to know what's in their food, and just because there's a small label on it, it doesn't mean that everyone's going to pay attention to it. And I think that's an interesting finding of that New Vermont study. You know, the new science that came out 2 weeks ago, there was a scientist that has 4 degrees from MIT. His name is Dr. Shiva Arundurai. And he found, they did a series of 4 papers. They're peer-reviewed papers. The last one was published 2 weeks ago in this journal, peer-reviewed journal, Agricultural Sciences. And what it showed is that the process of genetic engineering, contrary to what Monsanto says, it creates a significant cellular disruption in that plant. And so they analyzed over 6,400 studies for GMO soybeans, and they found that it significantly disrupts the basic cellular metabolism or structure to such a degree that it creates an alarming spike in formaldehyde, which is a class 1 carcinogen, a known carcinogen. And then at the same time, it absolutely depleted glutathione, which is a key main, your body's main antioxidant. So what it shows is that we're eating GMO soy, which is in 70% of processed foods, 75, and it has a cancer-causing chemical, and also the main health chemical, glutathione, which your body and plants and animals use to detoxify itself, that is absolutely depleted. So it's deficient in one of the main healthy chemicals that your body uses. And so the real question is, what does that do? We don't know yet, because we got to do more. The scientists have to conduct more tests. But it does absolutely shatter the myth from the 1990s that former Monsanto attorney Michael Taylor helped install, the idea that GMO crops, genetically engineered crops, are substantially equivalent to non-GMO crops or traditionally bred crops?
That's how they passed into law. In other words, you can basically, in order to say, oh, we have a novel form here, something new is happening, we're inserting genes into these plants, seeds, in order to make them more pesticide resistant to our specific pesticide, what would be the impact of that on the plant, on the environment, on the humans and animals that might consume it? What would be the impact, or that would even consume the water runoff? What would be the impact? Instead of doing a complete investigation of the impact before that they made it widely available, such that, you know, as you point out, 75% of all processed foods, before doing that, they passed it into the food supply by declaring it, as you say, substantially equivalent. In other words, they just said, well, we don't really need to study it all that much because it's substantially equivalent. What criteria did they use to determine that it was, that, you know, a GMO soy plant like the one that this MIT scientist found contained increased rates of a carcinogen and lower rates of a healthy antioxidant? You know, what criteria, I mean, that's one criteria. Oh, we looked at a GMO plant and a non-GMO plant, and we found X. We found it has a more carcinogen. We found it has lower levels of detoxifying antioxidants. What were the criteria they were looking at?
Well, it's pretty superficial criteria that they used. You know, does it look, smell, and taste the same? And they also looked at, you know, fat and content, and also, you know, what the nutritional profile. But they didn't really look at a deep dive into the nutritional profile and check out all the, you know, vitamins and minerals that a plant contains, nutrients. And they looked at basically just these really superficial criteria. And as a result, the thing is they have such a large variance in any nutritional differences that it's almost automatic for them to pass it. And so they declare these are crops are genetically substantially equivalent, and that gives them GRAS status or generally regarded as safe. And because of that, there's no independent peer-reviewed studies that are required for their approval. Mm-hmm. And they can basically get passed with basically rubber stamped with corporate industry science, what I call it, cigarette science. And that's one of the main problems. And interestingly enough, this paper that Dr. Arndura published 2 weeks ago, not only does it show formaldehyde and GMO soy and glutathione, it also shatters that myth of substantial equivalence, which came from a 1976 presidential directive under Gerald Ford that covered medical devices. So if medical devices were substantially equivalent, meaning a stethoscope, it had the same function, it would have had a few different parts as the previous stethoscope, then it would be fast-tracked for approval. Ironically, they've taken this and put it on living organisms, which in the food we're eating. And it's really not to govern safety of these crops. It's just to make sure that they're approved as soon as possible so industries can profit from that.
Yeah, that's, it's kind of, you know, I mean, sometimes we've said things like, you know, that's mechanistic and, you know, the body is not a machine. I mean, actually, we have such a poor vision and understanding of the human organism or any biological organism and how it works. And, you know, as a health reporter and everything, I can say that, you know, very often what we're called upon to do to kind of explain, you know, how something works in the body is to use a mechanical, you know, to liken us to a car. That's like, you know, one of the most common ones. Oh, you know, we're just like a car, because people can't even conceive of, you know, of the complexity and subtlety with which a living organism functions. It's just so hard to imagine. We haven't been educated to it. Our science kind of studies things in bits and parts, therefore doesn't capture it all that well. You know, so it's just, it's just incredible. And then in the end, even, you know, the government, you know, bases like a fast tracking of these food products, instead of doing proper study, they kind of rush it through as if, in fact, we all are just interchangeable mechanical parts. You know, it's really, really rather astounding. Now, when you say they use superficial characteristics, taste, smell, et cetera, I mean, how do they judge that? Was it a taste test group, or do they have a way of measuring how something smells? I mean, you know, what kind of, like, how would that even apply is what I'm trying to understand.
Well, they use tests. They do some basic nutritional components, but it's not a full chemical assessment of that plant.
I see.
And, you know, so, I mean, I'm just saying, like, if you were really to do an independent test, you would have to see how every major vitamin and mineral was impacted. You would have to see how just beyond fat, carbohydrate, that kind of profile that they're, that they're looking at. And I would just say, you're absolutely right. I mean, the complexity of even a simple organism like a plant is almost beyond your average citizen's understanding. And I think that's what this is. What Dr. Shiva Arundhuri did was the first systems biology approach. It tries to look at this thing as a whole system, not just as a component parts. So the trick that Monsanto does is they say that the agrobacterium is safe. That's a promoter gene that's put in these the genetic cassette for GMOs. They say that the BT toxin is safe and harmless to humans. So then it should be approved. They say that they use an antibiotic marker gene in this genetic cassette where they insert the foreign genes in. And they say all these things are safe in and of themselves. So when they're put together and inserted into a plant or an animal, therefore they should be considered safe. But what systems biology approach that Dr. Arundhuri and his team took shows really that we need a really holistic systems approach. And that is not what our current regulatory system is doing, at all, by any means.
So we're studying bits and parts, but we don't know how they all add up, how they come together, how they increase an effect. I mean, when they do what you're describing, the systems approach is the beginning of a cumulative science. And usually, you know, we do an additive science, which is like 1 + 1 + 1 = 3. And it's like, well, it's only 3. But that's additive. What we don't know is if the presence of, you know, like, let's say A, the presence of A, and let's say it's a value of 1, the presence of B is a value of 1, and C is a value of 1. But they don't, so we're doing an additive approach. A plus B plus C equals, you know, that's 3, 1, 2, 3. But if we did a multiplying approach, it could be something more. We could bring in an infinitesimal amount of something else, and it could have a multiplier effect. It could increase the toxicity of something. It could open a membrane that you want to have closed in the presence of another ingredient. So just knowing what one single ingredient does and then just treating them as all separate elements as if they're, you know, in a separate universe from each other with no interactive effect, I mean, you know, it just shows how the extent to which biological science and research is in its infancy. And, of course, back in 1992, which is 23 years ago, it wasn't as advanced, the kinds of advances that you're describing, you know, are beginning just to happen now. But even at the time, just looking, you know, at the material that you would have, like the analysis that you would have on an ingredient label, how much sugar, how many grams of carb, how many grams of fat, just that basic nutritional composition doesn't say a million other things about what's going on in that plant. For example, one of the reasons that many of the physicians and doctors and even the FDA themselves were recommending increased soy consumption initially, and I do say initially because I don't think anyone imagined or continues to recommend the high rates of soy consumption that this dissemination of this cheap food has produced. But back in the day, they initially recommended it because they said that it would help women through menopause. It would help prevent heart disease because people would not be eating meats which may contain saturated fats and everything. So there were all these reasons why soy was considered healthy. But the reason it was considered healthy, you know, for women is that it contained estrogenic components that therefore might help menopausal women experiencing lower estrogen levels, you know, with, and maybe they had symptoms like hot flashes or something else. So if they ate some soy, it could kind of mitigate that because the soy is contributing some estrogen, right? But, I mean, were they measuring? So we know that, you know, estrogen was considered one of the components in soy. Now we're also learning from this study glutathione is in soy. We're learning that as a toxic byproduct, you know, formaldehyde can be produced in soy. So in other words, that is like this, and this is just also a few elements. I've just mentioned three other elements of what might constitute a biochemical analysis other than saying, does it have the same amount of carbon protein as a conventional soy plant? And this, all of the other things that might be contained in the soy, that might be increased in the soy, that might interact negatively in the soy plant itself or when we consume it, in us when we consume it, you know, none of that was being looked at, was it? I mean, they didn't look at how many vitamins it had. It didn't look at, you know, what specific, you know, like tomato has lycopene right in it. If you read an ingredient label on a tomato sauce, it's not listing the lycopene or the other nutrients. So in fact, they didn't even do what could have been done, which was even a linear additive nutritional analysis. It contains this and this and this and this and this. They weren't looking at any of that at all back in 1992 when they said it was the same as any other plant.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I just say, like, I would just say when they first started approving these GMO crops, they were really in the stone age of genetics and understanding how the complex, inner workings of a cell and the genetic components work together. And I think today we have more sophisticated tools and more understanding of how, you know, so the chemical glyphosate was recently declared a carcinogen. You know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when it first came on the market, they said it was the safest chemical there was. It had less impact on humans and the environment. We know, you know, 25 years, 30 years later, that's not true. And so the more information we get about these products, the real concern is, one of the things is, there is new and emerging science, and I know that Monsanto wants to deny all this stuff. But if you look at epigenetics, which talks about the delicate interplay that genes have on regulating our body and our body functions on a daily and almost a moment-by-moment basis, they believe that that problems that a parent has, like with famine or undergoing hunger, would impact not only their children, but down to the third generation. Genetically, it could have an impact. That's called epigenetics. You know, and the question is really, how do these chemicals and how does changing in the genetic structure of a food, a novel food product, how does it, what impact is that having? And the real question is, without labeling and without further investigation of the science, we'll never know. I think that's really what concerns Americans more than anything else.
We'll never know because we won't know because it won't be on the label, and we'll never know because we are not pushing for the science to be done because we're claiming that a science already has been done. And in fact, we're, you know, there are a lot, if you publish an article on this topic or anyone who mentions GMOs, there'll be a whole lot of people jumping on in comments and screaming about science. They know nothing about science because we're talking about 25-year-old science. Who gets up and says, the science has been done, you know, on any topic where the science is 25 years old in a field where there is change? And the only reason why there is less change in this field is because the Monsanto and other biotech companies withhold from availability for research purposes to scientists, they're seeds. You can't, they can't get hold of the seeds. They can't study the seeds. So this is like, you know, in any other area of science, if you said, okay, shut up, this can't be studied again. The science was done 25 years ago. Now we know the science. That's all we need to know. We don't want any more probing, advances, new understanding, increase of knowledge, or, you know, anything else that may have changed that we might need to look at that might be impacting whatever science we thought we found in this area. No, we're going to close and lock the vault on that. The science has been done, and then we're going to declare ourselves pro-scientists and get on the internet and hammer on anyone who wants to look at any emerging science about this. I mean, it's actually, I mean, the scientists that I've interviewed and spoken with are outraged by this, and there are many people who dare not speak up about it because their grants, their commonality with colleagues, they're publishing their papers and their articles. You know, there's an atmosphere of fear around science. So, you know, because of this industry incursion into science, even in academic scientific centers, the very places where we need science, we need the new science, we need current and updated science. Imagine, you know, the effect of these foods on our agriculture, our environment, our, you know, our humans and other living species remains unknown. But because the effect in science has been of a closing the vault and declaring you have the science that's 25 years old. And then when we, as we're doing today with you, Dave and Lisa, drill into the science, we find that it's ancient science that was not even current at the time that it was declared case closed back in 1992.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say there's been a systematic, you know, suppression of science and scientists in the last, you know, 25 years here in the U.S.
Right. I mean, how is our country going to move forward in any arena, you know, with this kind of shutdown in science? This is what used to be, you know, our forte and what we were known for. And yet we also have the arrogance that science is done abroad, and science has been done abroad, you know, on the effects of GMOs on health. The WHO study is an example. There have been animal studies done by international scientists. Americans, naively and ignorantly, you know, go, this isn't as good because it's not American, because we have the greatest science. I mean, under these circumstances, how could we have the greatest science? It's a sad state of affairs, really. Lisa, when you talk to, you know, moms, to farmers, I mean, are they aware of these complexities? Are they just kind of like, this is too much? Maybe there's some workaround and, you know, we don't need to worry about this. I mean, how are people able to handle the, you know, the full weight of all the things we're discussing today as it affects the food they feed their children?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think it's interesting that when you bring up moms and farmers, they're the ones that actually, I would say, have, you know, some of that real-world experience and observation. You know, mm-hmm. if you talk to farmers, for example, whether you talk to a farmer who's been using genetically engineered seed, like Roundup Ready corn or soy, you know, or what have you, or, you know, the other rest of the commodity crops, you know, they will tell you that, you know, they're not seeing the yield that they used to see, you know, that they have the real world experience to say, you know, these, you know, maybe you had higher yields in the beginning and it's like a, you know, it's an inverted, you know, it's a bell curve, right, where you mm-hmm. may see a higher yield at first and then it dramatically drops off because there's that adaptation in nature, right? And farmers are concerned about their land and their soil and preserving that. And you know, I have two uncles who farm here in Iowa, and they say, you know, we don't like using the pesticides, but you get on this treadmill, right? And they both now have gone over to conventional because they're concerned about the pesticides. So they have some of that real world experience. And I would say a lot of farmers, you know, they see the issues And so, you know, while I'm not going to say that science would not be relevant to them, but they have more of kind of that, you know, common sense way of thinking about it, right?
Mom, well, they have the sensory feedback of, like,
yes,
knowing what actually happens. So they're not reading a blog comment
exactly
of some probably PR firm that comments, you know, they send all these
right
robotic commentators out there on blogs to go, you're anti-science, it's not even a person. It's like an intern at a PR firm commenting through, you know, 100 different identities. One person is generating these comments, and that's like a, you know, a kind of distanced virtual notion of science. What you're describing is they have the actual sensory feedback of,
right,
you know, season after season of crop decline and poor plants and poor yield and you know, all those, that's actually the real science, because that's an observable phenomenon. Also, you know, the other thing, Lisa, is that when they say, we've studied glyphosate and it's a safe pesticide or a safer pesticide, you know, it's one thing to say something's safe if I have a drop of this in the laboratory and I compare it with a drop of that. It's another thing to say it's safe when it's in 95% of a growing food product like the soy foods that were the subject of study, you know, by Dr. Ayudurai. You know, and it's a $1 billion global industry and everyone's eating it, everyone's growing it, and you're using the glyphosates at that proportion, you know? Like, maybe marginally safer than something else you were comparing it to back,
right,
you know, 30 years ago or whatever. But, you know, but when you have this mass dissemination of it, suddenly you have a much higher level of impact than people or plants or nature itself can absorb. And none of that is factored in. See, our use of it is systemic. That's a systemic use. But our study of it is not systemic until this recent study by Dr. Ayudurai.
Right. You know, and when you start talking about, you know, pesticides, I mean, now we're going back to, you know, you're talking about glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, which is what, you know, our, you know, the top five crops have been engineered to withstand, right? So, like, where,
mm-hmm,
you know, I grew up and where we started our organization from in Iowa, you know, in fact, I was just looking at a map here shortly of the USDA, from the USDA, from APHIS, of, you know, the amount of concentration of glyphosate sprayed, you know, and Iowa is completely blanketed, right, you know, and,
wow,
you know, spraying of these chemicals. And so now that we've developed resistance, now we're going to these more toxic chemicals, which, of course, are more volatile. And, you know, I'll just give the, you know, the real-world example again of, you know, where my family lives in Iowa, my parents. And, you know, David and I, we used to go out just south of town, and this was our idea of relaxation when we needed a break. We'd go out for a drive and take pictures of superweed, right? And so I went out there the other day, and I see there's no superweed. And so I look, and it's, I mean, you've never seen more perfect fields in your life, right? And it's Liberty Link. So now that Liberty Link was finally approved this spring, Liberty Link is a staff variety, so it has glyphosate, Roundup, and 2,4-D. And both of those were declared possible carcinogens just incidentally this year by the World Health Organization. And so now we're spraying both. And, you know, the problems with 2,4-D, aside from the carcinogenicity, oh, I have such a hard time with that word, besides the fact that it's a known carcinogen, is that it's also very volatile. And that means that it can spread, you know, much more so than, you know, some other agrochemicals. So
exactly. So there again, you have like a systemic effect. In other words, it's studied in a lab and then it's disseminated and it has a systemic effect. And you use it over and over, it stops working. You have to use something even more toxic with more carcinogens, and that's another systemic effect. Then you put it in plants, and instead of the plants giving you the antioxidants you need to detoxify from chemicals, you will have less, and that's another systemic effect. So we're coming to the end of our show here. We've got like about another minute at this point. So I think we've seen very ever more strongly why we need to label, we need to know, we need the science. We need not just labeling science, we need labeling knowing, but we need scientific knowing. And you're pointing to all the ways that that is incredibly crucial for our food, our health, our children. Thank you, David Murphy and Lisa Stocky of Food Democracy Now, for being with us again. I'm sure we'll have you back. Please, everyone, go to Food Democracy Now on the web, sign up, get the newsletters, know when to take action. Super important. Support this organization. They've really been in the lead on this. And thank you for being with us this week, listeners, on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I hope you all have a wonderful week. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Thanks.
Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Dave and Lisa.
Thanks.